On this episode of Baseball Barbagas, we react to the first no-hitter since 2024, but was it any good? Then we do the disappointing draft, and we preview the Women's College World Series. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbagas. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbagas, the only baseball podcast in the world that would never triple crotch chop up 6-0. But maybe up by one run. I'm Jordan Schusterman. That is not Jake Mintz. He is on vacation in Italy. Instead, we have one of my favorite people on the baseball internet. It is Jack, a.k.a. Jolly Olive, my favorite member of the John Boy cinematic universe.
Oh, baby.
Jolly, welcome to Baseball Barbacast, my friend.
I am honored. One of the best text messages I've ever received came yesterday from one Jordan Schusterman. Our text history is just littered with my OOTP streams, so I'm so excited to chop it up and get real nerdy with you on this show.
A lot to cover on this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbacast. It's always weird. We didn't do a Monday show. We go 3 times a week, so there's a lot to cover. We have a no-hitter to talk about, which is really something. We have the Cubs losing 10 in a row. We have Abner Uribe doing very silly things on a baseball field. And, of course, Jolly's here, so we're going to talk about the Mets. And we're going to finish with one of my favorite events on the sports calendar, the Women's College World Series. But, Jolly, before we get started, who are you? What the heck? How did you end up on this podcast? You mentioned I text and bother you about your OOTP streams. You are also a prolific YouTuber. What are your general credentials that would earn you this hallowed invite?
Well, first off, is that how you normally start conversations? First of all, who are you? That's a little aggressive there. I've been in this game for about 5 years now. The reason I was so excited to come on this show is because my first trip to winter meetings, I was a scared little bug, and the warmest faces in the room were that of you and Jake Mintz, and I've been forever grateful for that, for making me feel included. But yeah, I'm just your local baseball YouTuber, video essayist who's dipping his toe in trivia and unfortunately covering the Mets on a week-to-week basis, which we will talk about eventually. But yeah, happy to be here.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. Let us wait no more because we've been waiting a long time for this one. Our opener this episode is a no-hitter. Okay, Jolly. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest. All right. The Astros on Monday at Globe Death Field, formerly Globe Life Field, but there is not much life happening inside that ballpark anymore, certainly on the offensive side of things. The Houston Astros threw a no-hitter. I say the Houston Astros threw a no-hitter because it was not just one individual. This was a combined effort courtesy of rookie right-hander Tatsuya Imai, lefty reliever Steven Okert, and rookie right-hander, a real rookie making his major league debut,
crazy,
Alimber Santa, who finished it off with 2 innings. This was a blowout, a 9-0 domination by Houston over a Texas team that has completely forgot how to hit baseballs in their home ballpark. But this was the first no-hitter we had since September 4th, 2024, which was also a combined no-no. That was the Cubs against the Pirates, Shota Imanaga, Porter Hodge, and Nate Pearson. The last solo no-no was Blake Snell in August of that year. But we had this long no-hitter drought, which was strange as we've talked about how great pitching has become in Major League Baseball and how hard it is to hit. And yet, we just haven't had one in quite some time. So before we get into the specifics of this one, I'm curious, do you care about no-hitters? Like, what has your relationship been with no-hitters during your baseball fandom and now being a content creator and someone who covers the sport, professionally in a way?
So I think by definition, I care about no-hitters, but I'm obviously more fascinated by the perfect game, being that it's a more illustrious and exclusive club to join. Here's my gripe, because I've got gripes with this no-hitter, as I imagine you do as well, being that it's not a very sexy line of pitching. It's not a very sexy line of names, really, either. But it comes down to the Astros themselves, Jordan. Did you know that 5 of the last 11 no-hitters in Major League Baseball history belong to the Houston Astros? Did you know that the Houston Astros are basically the cultivator of the combined no-hitter, the third ever Kono, and first real one when Roy Oswalt threw just 1 inning in that game, belonged to the Houston Astros in 2003. And three of their last five no hitters are combined no hitters. This is kind of what they do, and I'm sick of it. It's not pure to me. Give me the Edwin Jackson 8-walk no hitter in a uniform you never associate him with over this any day of the week.
And let me tell you, what you are referring to there at the end did seem like the direction that this Tatsuya Imai performance was yes. going. As if you watched the first inning of this game, at no point would you be like, well, clearly we're headed for
it. We're making history tonight.
this is the one we've been waiting for. I do want to focus on Imai as a character, because I know he's someone you did a whole video about in the offseason, as a lot of us were really excited about him coming over from NPB, and he's just had this very strange and certainly in some ways concerning start to his career. But let's also focus on just like what happened in this game, because as you mentioned, not the sexiest line, more walks than strikeouts. The Rangers did have some hard hit balls, and sometimes you like that. You want to have that cool defensive play, right? And Jake Myers, you know, ran some down. There were a couple good infield plays at third base, but at no point was this, it felt like we were building towards something special. And I have to say, as we kind of pivot back towards the pitchers involved, the Alimber Santa being part of this kind of redeemed this whole situation for
yes.
me. Because this is so cool. It's so absurd, and also was only possible because they were up 7-0, right? I mean, there's no way, as injured as the Astros pitchers are, there's no way that this dude would be in there making his major league debut if they weren't up by a bunch of runs. And at the same time, I kind of give Joe Espada credit for being like, screw it, we're going to go for this combined no-hitter with this guy making his major league debut. So that's the part of this that's certainly my favorite. So I don't know if of the things that are redeeming qualities of this low-quality no-no, I have to say the Santa debut, it really, really warms my heart.
It's about the only thing that makes it memorable, because, I mean, if you go through combined no-hitter history, it's very hard, unless it's your favorite team, it's very hard to remember each of the names that are attached to those events. I just think it's so bizarre to me because, like you said, Tatsuya Imai has had anything but a normal year so far. He's endured, you know, a pair of awful starts in Seattle. He had already had an injured-less stint. We've heard about his trouble acclimating to life in America so far after, you know, this offseason where the buzz was this guy could get a 7-to-8-year deal. Instead, it kind of ended with a wet fart of negotiations. And now here he is already making baseball history in his second month. It's just, it's a little bit misleading. 6 innings, 4 walks, 2 Ks. That feels very, very accurate to the quality of pitching you might have seen in this game.
Well, and it's also, it's like, so he has this strange injured stint where it's like, is he hurt or is he just having a bad time? Is he like, his rehab starts were terrible. He did not seem like he like earned his way back, but you know, he's making all this money and they have all these injured pitchers and he has to stay in the rotation. If you didn't watch the game and you saw, oh my God, Imai was part of this no hitter. What a step forward, the signs of progress. He's figuring stuff out. I mean, like I said, just watch the first inning. Look at the pitch plot of he's just still scattering everything. He has no command of the slider. He's still really only throwing two pitches. And this isn't to say he's doomed to never be a good major leaguer, but this is just another strange chapter in this rookie season to where you mentioned that very well said wet fart of a negotiation. You know, that was great. That was a perfect tribute to Jake Mintz. Like that is something that Jake would have said, you know, like that feels like, oh yeah, that's,
I was studying tape the night before, obviously. You
that's
know,
good. Yeah. I have no doubt. The other part about that negotiation and then the contract I ended up getting was, okay, maybe the league, you know, was skeptical and they didn't want to commit to him all the way. It's like, okay, that's fine. But everyone said, well, this is, wow, what a steal for Houston. They finally signed from some MPB and, you know, he can opt out, right? The way that Boris was spinning things, right? They're like, oh, well, he can opt out and he's just going to pitch great on this deal or re-enter the market and he'll get the big deal he's looking for. I don't know if he's opting out. I mean, there's a lot of season left, but he's got a lot of things to fix if he wants to re-enter the market, which is just a reminder that, like, if the Astros want to get the season back on track and if he wants to get his MLB career, you know, on get going in the right direction, he just has a lot to figure out, and this is a cool, weird, bizarre footnote in it. And maybe even if we watch it and are not impressed, maybe this does give him some amount of confidence that he can, you know, get a bunch of outs in major league games. But It's just so weird. This is such a strange addition to this strange season for him.
Yeah, I mean, I know the discussion is veering towards this way because we're going to talk about the Texas Rangers. But I mean, this game was big for, I think, the Astros as a team, not really so much Imai himself, although it's good to get six scoreless innings under your belt no matter who you are. The Astros are 3.5 games out of the AL West. They're still very much in the conversation in what is undoubtedly the worst division in baseball. And part of that was beating up on the Texas Rangers, who very much look like they're suffering from the exact same problems they suffered from in the middle of the season last year before a bunch of AAA recruits came up and almost resurrected their season. It's their core guys. They're just not hitting again. And they're not hitting against some of the worst pitching staffs in baseball at that.
Yeah. Now, you know, they, when we're writing this rundown yesterday, it's like, oh my God, they have the worst home OPS in 50 years.
Whoa.
Okay. And
what a stat.
So,
there's
a stat for you. And I want to come back to Globe Death Field in a second. Now, of course, they go last night, and because baseball is baseball, they put up 8 runs in the first inning, and it's like, okay, great. None of us have any idea what's going on. So they do bounce back and get a win, and the Astros still have some issues to sort out themselves for sure. But Texas, man, like, last year is when we really all started to notice. They fire their hitting coach and they bring in fellow podcaster Brett Boone to really liven things up. Now he's back to podcasting and not coaching the Rangers anymore. But like I said, their home OPS, and I think it's probably gone up a few points after last night, but it's like down near 600. And something has happened in Globe Life Field over the last few years to turn it into one of the craziest pitcher-friendly ballparks in the league. And I've seen some stuff written about it and speculated about, but it's one of the stranger storylines in the sport. And because the Rangers have just been stuck in the middle of irrelevance essentially since they won the World Series, no one's really talking about it. But I thought that game appropriately for them to be no hit there by a very bad Tetsuya Imai and Okert and a guy making his major league debut was like, wait a minute, this is not going well for Texas. And yet, as you mentioned, they're not dead either, because the AL West isn't exactly covering itself in glory.
Yeah, no one is dead in the AL West, mind you. But with the Rangers, outside of, you know, my lovely New York Mets doing them a favor and giving them Brandon Nimmo, who's been their best hitter, it is a very similar story. I mean, thankfully, they're getting something out of Jock Peterson this time around, because this time last year, things were very, very bad for him.
Dire.
Who was as consistent of a DH as you could get in Major League Baseball, who was seemingly available every year as well. But it's, again, their main guys either being hurt or just not producing. The Corey Seager back stuff is scary because there's just kind of been recurring, lingering injuries with him ever since the World Series year. You're never really going to get a full 130-ish games out of Corey Seager, and I think you have to be content with that reality as a Rangers fan. But you don't have to be content with the rest of it. And it's the fact of the matter that even with this kind of reset that they tried with their lineup, bringing in some new faces and restructuring what they already had, the results have been kind of similar. It's been a lot of the story has been starting pitching. They're getting length out of those guys, not necessarily great quality, but their offense isn't doing enough to back that up. So while they're staying afloat for now in a weak AL West, you have to imagine that one of these teams, probably the Seattle Mariners, if I had to take a guess, is going to eventually heat up and run away with it. But everyone out West has problems of their own right now.
Yeah. And last thing on Texas, like, I think what's so disappointing is, and this year's been a little bit different because their rotation hasn't been awesome. It's been like DeGrom's been good, allowing home runs for like the first time ever. And Evaldi's been good. Gore has certainly been disappointing, but he's the kind of guy that would
keep an eye on that trade.
Yeah. Yeah.
Keep an eye
well,
on that one.
Right. Well, yeah. Let's move Devin Fitzgerald to the side. Okay. Sure. And, you know, Gavin Fien hasn't even played. Like, let's just move those guys to the side. The reality is Mackenzie Gore runs pretty hot and cold. And so would it shock me if he rattles off a scoreless month of June? No, but he has not delivered in the way that you would hope. And yet, like, their ridiculously anonymous bullpen has generally been great for the second year in a row. And yet they're not hitting anywhere close to enough for it to matter. And the Seager injuries, you're never going to be shocked. What was disappointing is that he also wasn't performing for really the first time in his career. You know, there's some bright spots, like Josh Young has generally been quite good when he's played. Jake Berger has looked better. And as you mentioned, Peterson and Nimmo is a great trade. Sorry to sell you relatively. But you know, we'll get to them later. But no, it's just not enough. And whatever is going on there hitting at Globe Life is just really, really, really strange. As for Houston, you know, like, this is the other reason why last night was disappointing. They just swept the Cubs at Wrigley. We're about to talk about the Cubs. Feels like, okay, maybe we're figuring some stuff out on the mound. Maybe Hunter Brown's about to come back. You know, maybe we have Yordan went through like a 2-week kind of slump. Now he started to hit home runs in every game again. But they're still just such a mess on the mound. I mean, the hole that they've dug themselves on the mound, and you know, they've Arrigetti's looked okay, and I don't know. Houston is a tough one to figure out at this point. For so long, you always said, trust Houston, trust Houston, trust Houston. They'll figure it out. And remember, they did still win the same number of games as the Tigers last year. As right. disastrous as it was for them to finally miss the postseason, they had dug themselves out of some pretty big holes the last 2 years. So I don't want to count that. I think, let's just finish this conversation on this. Who you got the rest of the way, Rangers or Astros? Not even that they're going to make the postseason or anything, but like just like wins the rest of the season.
I think Astros. Just because if you think about it, like identity wise, when they were winning as much as they did in the late 2010s and early 2020s, they were still a top heavy team that didn't have a lot of depth. Yeah. It's just that their top heavy stars never really got hurt outside of Yordan. So they were able to weather that. You saw the very ugly side of their depth early in the season, but you know, now they got Jeremy Peña back, Jose Altuve. When's he coming back? You know, Spencer Arrigetti did, you know, a lot for them in these seven starts. He really, even in his first start against the Rockies, I remember him coming up in the midst of a nasty losing streak and just giving them seven scoreless. And like those kind of performances can go a long way. At the same time, like even their attempts to acquire depth, like, you know, the Mike Burrows trade where they might end up a big loser in that three team swap as well. Like I like their odds more than the Rangers, because every time I try and buy into the Rangers, this ugly side of inconsistency rears its head with their offense. I don't know how much I buy into the home stadium stock, because we had that narrative with Seattle a couple years ago with the crooked mound and everything there. So who the hell knows really what's going on? But something about the uniform, as dumb as that might sound.
Totally valid. I'm just, last thing on Houston, I'm just looking at there's so many things about the season. It's like, how did we get here? This will be relevant when we do our disappointing draft coming up here soon. But I'm looking at their roster resource page right now, and I'm just looking at their rotation, and the top three arms are Spencer Arrigetti, Kaiwei Tang, Peter Lambert.
Kaiwei like Tang, ousted from the Giants. Whoa.
Dude, and he's been throwing well, and I like what Peter Lambert's been doing. Like, this is not a shot at them, but you just, it's like, took a screenshot of that. SP1, Arrigetti. SP2, Kaiwei Tang. SP3, Peter Lambert.
They need Hunter Brown so bad.
Baseball, I know, they do. It seems like he's maybe on his way back. All right, speaking of teams with serious pitching concerns, let me deliver you a field report. Jolly, I am in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where the Chicago Cubs lost their 10th game in a row last night at PNC Park. I will be here for the Wednesday game as well. A couple weeks ago, I planned this trip. I said, wow, the NL Central, I got to go check out the impossible to defeat Chicago Cubs. The Pittsburgh Pirates are playing well. This is going to be this could be like a fight for first place. Instead, this was a fight to stay out of last place, as the Chicago Cubs now are tied with Pittsburgh at the bottom of the NL Central. They are still three games over 500, and they would be in second place in most of the other divisions. But that is not an option for them. They are in the NL Central in 2026, and that means they are in last place. Big picture for you. What have you? I mean, this is just one of the craziest stretches we've ever seen from any team in the early season to win 20 of 23 and then lose 10 in a row. But what were your opinions on the Cubs coming into the season, and then kind of what have you seen from them so far?
Well, I mean, kind of the opposite of the Astros. I really liked the depth of this team. I thought what they were building, especially with the pitching staff, like I thought this was going to be sustainable. And I still do believe in this Cubs team, just because I really think they can throw a lot of different pitchers out there and their defense can pick up a ton of that slack. It's kind of the opposite opinion I hold of the Pirates, where their pitching needs to be excellent to offset their defense. but this 9-game losing streak has been brutal. I mean, what a awfully roller coastery season that's got to make you nauseous for Cubs fans, where you have two separate 10-game heaters. Now you have a 10-game loser in the first 2 months of the year. It just gives you whiplash. I've said this for basically any time I've talked about the Cubs into a microphone, but I just think the Cade Horton injury really set this team back a little bit. That was the guy that was going to be counted on them big time this year to take a sophomore leap. I thought he was really impressive last year. I kind of ran out of gas towards the end of the season, and now this injury really kneecaps his development. And I think they're feeling the weight out of that, because now they've lost Edward Cabrera, Matthew Boyd with one of the freak pitcher injuries of all time, and suddenly your back is against the wall with the guys that were supposed to be back-end rotation options now being, you know, your potential stoppers, or, you know, what you'd like to be a stopper. They're just going through a really bad phase right now, but I think as long as that lineup is healthy, they're going to hit their way out of it, and I think their defense is consistent as any team in baseball. That I do think they'll be fine. It's just the NL Central kind of owed us a year where everyone finally performed to those preseason expectations. It just happens to be all the teams are doing it at the same time.
Yeah, well said. And I'll come back to the Central in a second. I think my take on the Cubs, and what I wrote last night off the game, was really focused on just the division circumstances, the weirdness of the streaks like this. But to me, the pitching is still the story. And there's a lot of focus right now. Craig Counsell keeps getting asked, oh my God, you had this amazing offense and now everybody's slumping, and Suzuki's striking out 40% of the time, and Bregman barely has any slugging, and, you know, Nico Horner's cooled off, and PCA, we know he goes hot and cold. Dansby Swanson's hitting like 170. I'm just not worried about the lineup. I'm just not. These players are too good. Maybe they're not all going to break out again and turn into this juggernaut that we saw during these win streaks. But also, I think that's more likely than all of them being this bad for that much longer. And so I just, as frustrating as it is to watch them hit with runners in scoring position the last 2 weeks, I'm pushing that to the side, and I'm saying that's going to work itself out. However, on the mound, I am worried. I think what we saw the last two nights was actually an interesting contrast, because Ben Brown is someone to be excited about.
Yes.
This is a pitcher with real stuff that can strike guys out and not rely on the defense, which is not a bad thing. I mean, he's also has gotten ground balls in his career, so he could, you know, kind of blend those two things. Strike throwing has been an issue for him. You know, obviously, he's had some health issues. I'm a believer in him. He looked great on Monday. Jordan Wicks, former first-round pick, has had to stop and start, you know, beginning to his career. It's just not good enough. I mean, and he said as much last night. He gives up 5 runs in the first inning. It's his first start of the season. Coming up, you know, with Cabrera going on with the blister. They're hopeful that Cabrera is going to be coming back. Boyd, I think, will be back in the next couple of weeks. That's important. Remember, they were counting on Justin Steele coming back.
Yes.
And he had a setback in his return from Tommy John that is essentially means he's nowhere close to coming back. Now, are they still hopefully comes back this season? Yes. But I'm no longer counting on that. And frankly, the other situation here is you have guys, your veterans in your rotation are very homer prone, whether that's Imanaga, whether that's Taillon. Colin Ray's done his job. And you just don't have the depth. I mean, their top pitching prospect, who could have maybe been this year's Cade Horton, is Jackson Wiggins, and he's hurt. He hasn't really been pitching. He was supposed to be maybe an option in AAA. And they just don't have any other guys right now in the upper minors that you could turn to. And you look around the league, and there's a lot of teams, a lot of the most successful teams have quality options that they can pluck from AAA. And maybe Jordan Wicks can still become that. And again, I think Ben Brown is worth believing in, but that's the concern, and that's why they got to get Boyd and Cabrera back as soon as possible, and hope that they can perform to that degree. I mean, Cabrera is also kind of a weird one to project anyway, but you did see some positive signs there early on in his Cubs tenure, and you got to hope that he can kind of give you more of that soon. So that's my general Cubs take, is just the pitching. I am worried about it. How do you address it? Can you make a trade this early? Maybe, but you know, who's trying to give you good starting pitching in the beginning of June? I mean, that's unlikely to happen at this point.
You took the words right out of my mouth there, because I think the Cubs were good to fire one of their two bullets, that being Owen Casey, to go get Edward Cabrera and make that deal happen. It's a shame that it kind of bit them in the butt here early. With Ben Brown, who I was going to hopefully bring up if you didn't mention him here, I am optimistic. I'm also worried, because they carved out this really like good multi-inning high leverage relief role for him, where his troubles in the prior years were, you know, third time through the order and getting length out of games. He was the classic case of five nice innings. You try and get him for the sixth, and then it all unravels and it ruins the whole outing. Yeah. But so far, you know, the start against Pittsburgh, where he unfortunately didn't get a decision, six innings, one earned run, that's an encouraging sign for him. I just hope that it doesn't turn the other way and ruin the confidence he had going, because, you know, when you looked up and down this pitching staff, he was the top performer on the pitching staff, even when everybody was healthy. Outside of that, I was going to mention, if there was ever a team to move the market up early and make a trade, it is the Cubs. Their farm system isn't deep, but they have one more bullet they can fire, and that is Kevin Alcantara, who they got in the Anthony Rizzo trade back in 2021. He's been kind of knocking on the door at AAA forever. They called him up. I think I'm not sure if he's still with the club now.
He is.
So I don't know how much room they have for him, because even Michael Conforto's hitting for them. That is a piece they could move. Like you said, I'm not sure any team really wants to sell pitching in May outside of maybe three teams, and one of them being my favorite team. So who the hell knows?
we're almost there. Joel. I know you've been itching.
So I'm just itching to talk about them. They're so fun.
Yes, it's a great point. And hey, you could still trade Matt Shaw. Like, he's been a versatile piece that has kind of fit into this new utility role, but that's a valuable player. Pedro Ramirez, another guy that's come up. But other than that, the farm is not in a great place. And so if we do get all the way to the deadline, like, good luck outbidding some of these other teams that need pitching or need other stuff, because you just don't have the ammo in the same way. So I agree with you, though. Them at the trade deadline is going to be very, very interesting to watch. All right, Jolly, let's take a break. And when we return, you will get your wish. We're going to talk about the New York Mets. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jordan Schusterman here with the great Jolly Olive. My pal Jack is a fan of the New York Mets, and that has been a tough time. honestly, it's great, because I'm sure there's some folks listening to the pod that are being introduced to you for the first time. They'll be like, oh, this guy sounds cool. I like him. Oh, let me look it up. Let me look him up on Twitter. Let's see what he's been tweeting about. Oh. Well, if you were listening to Jolly sound like a totally smart, rational analyst, which he is, I should say.
Thank you, man.
Last segment, it's time to totally throw that in the garbage and let Jolly be a fan. But we're going to expand this beyond the New York Mets, who have certainly been, I think, the most disappointing team in baseball. I don't think that's that hot of a take, even among non-Mets fans. But I want to broaden this out. And so what we're going to do, we are going to do the disappointing draft. This is going to be an exercise where we are going to take turns and we are going to look around the league. And I think that this is timely, because last night it was not just the Mets who embarrassed themselves among clubs who we had real expectations for. And I'm also curious, as someone who knows ball, like, who are the other teams that you look at and say, oh my God, what's going on? Now, we've already touched on the Astros and Rangers and Cubs, so you could bring them up again if you want. But I think that there's some other teams that deserve more attention. That said, you have the first pick in the disappointing draft, and to take it away, who are you going to go with, Jolly?
Jordan, I'm nothing if not an entertainer.
Yep.
I will be passing on the New York Mets.
Oh my God.
With the number one overall pick in the draft. Mostly because I want to hear what you have to say about them. I'm going to let you pick them. But I also have a good reason for this. I have a good reason.
Sure.
Because there's a team that has the same record as them, also in the National League, also with a ton of money on their payroll, except this team, unlike my Mets, can't, you know, just kind of pivot, sell this year and chalk it up as a transition year, which is, I think, what the Mets were trying to do, bridging the gap from their farm system being ready for the major league jump. This team is locked. This is the team. This team, number one overall pick in the disappointing draft, is the San Francisco Giants. There is no way out for this team. There is only maybe two players on this team that could be sold at the deadline, even if they want to do that. They kind of stole a ton of offseason headlines by experimenting a lot with what they had. There was moving Jung-Hoo Lee off of center field. There was saying, we're the only team that believes in Luis Arias to play second base, so we'll pay him to be our second baseman. We're going to hire a college manager because no one's ever done that before, and we want to shake things up. It has not worked. It has blown up in a catastrophic way, to the point where even the Giants cannot hang their hat on the fact that they are around the middle every year. The past 4 years, that's been the story with them. They've hung around 500. They've been right in the middle of things ever since that 2021 blip of 170 wins, or 107 wins, excuse me. Now they're 11 games.
It might as well been 170.
It felt that way. Wow, it was so fun to watch. Now they're 22-33. They're not getting pitching, even from the guys they've counted on in prior years. They're not hitting at all. They're not playing great defense either. They don't really seem to do anything well. And while I am basking in the misery of my favorite team, the New York Mets, pretty much doing all of those same things, the saving grace is that, like, well, most of the guys that were brought in were on 1 year, 2 year deals. They'll be gone, I guess, in that time span, and we can just kind of reset. With the Giants, it's Devers for a long time. It's Arias for another couple years. It's Adames for 5 more years. It's Chapman for 4 more years. Like, this is the team, and I don't know what they do to fix this situation. So they are my most disappointing team, just because I really thought this year we might see some headway.
So I really wanted to get the Giants in this draft, so I feel like I got sniped. So this is great work. A few minor corrections before I like super duper agree with you.
Okay.
Arise is a 1 year deal, and that's but I bring that up because he's one of the only things that's going right.
He's the like, best he's defensive the, second baseman in baseball.
He's probably the one you're going to trade. Yep. Like, that's, which is kind of sad if you're Luis Arraez, who's already been traded under like kind of depressing, weird circumstances a few times. So that bums me out, because I also believed in Luis Arraez, and I was like, this is crazy. I think he was going to be at plus 10, OAA? No. Did I think he could play second base if he worked with Ron Washington and was healthy? Yeah, I did. And I also thought he could hit, and like, I think he could be helpful. But in this lineup, it's like, who cares? You know, it's like, what is this actually doing for you? So as much as I love Arise, and that's like one thing they hit on, yeah, I mean, this has been a disaster. And I think for me, the reason why, I mentioned this on a show recently, to me, it's so disappointing, because I wanted the Tony Vitello experiment to kind of like happen with an organization that would like give him a chance to succeed. Not that I cared whether he wins or loses, but it's like, this doesn't even feel like a fair representation of Tony Vitello in any sense, This roster, and frankly, just a lot of the organization, is just not in a great place. So yeah, so it's a great pick. I don't know if they would have been my first pick had you taken the Mets as I expected.
Oh, interesting.
But they were going to be one of my first picks. So well done. That said, Victor Wembanyama is still on the board, and that's the New York Mets, whose $400 million payroll has left them with 13% playoff odds here as June approaches. High. Does seem high. It does actually seem pretty high, and speaks to the fact that people, unlike the Giants, who, though I said, oh, they're going to be a wild card team, idiot, there were not that many people that were like believing in the Giants.
Yeah.
Whereas the Mets, with their offseason of overhauling, as chaotic as it was, at the end of the day, we looked at the roster and said, well, damn, that's a lot of good baseball players. You know, like, it's weird, as the point I have now made more recently in a derogatory sense, it looks like a fantasy baseball team.
Yes.
It doesn't really look like a baseball team. It looks like a fantasy baseball team. But hey, sometimes fantasy baseball teams are good. Hey, well, let's bring it back to OOTP. Nice. Maybe this is something that you can maybe relate to, right? When you play out of the park baseball, which, for those unfamiliar, you know, baseball, the top of the line baseball simulation game, you're bringing in all these talented players. And then sometimes your team sucks and you're like, why? What the hell? look at their stats. Look at their ratings. What's the problem?
Right.
Obviously, in the case of the Mets, it's more complicated than that. The injuries have been very disappointing. You have barely seen the headlining players in the lineup at the same time. And so, in a sick way, that's like what you're supposed to fall back on and be like, woohoo, you know,
It's
not so bad. Yeah, woo. And and as you pointed out, like, okay, some of these contracts you could trade and reload the farm and then try again next year. But I'll just make the main point that I do every time we talk about the Mets since Steve Cohen bought the team, which is just like, I'm sorry, I don't care. I don't care what this year was supposed to be, that it was supposed to be some sort of bridge. When you're spending that much money and you are bringing in premium free agents, you are saying that, and once you gave Juan Soto the world, like, you should be competing for championships. You should be trying to be in the postseason. You should be trying to, you know, beat the Phillies and, you know, take down the Braves, let alone try and be like the Dodgers. And for this to be the season, I don't have to explain it to you. It's just disappointing is the understatement of the podcast. And that's why we're here with me, with them plummeting to me at the number two pick. I can't believe it.
I mean, you characterized most of that well, especially the Wemby fell to number two. To just put a number to what you were saying, Juan Soto, Francisco Lindor, and Bo Bichette have played 9 games together this year out of the 54 possible. I'm not giving the Mets any excuses. I've been resident excuse maker for this team for years now, and this is not one of the instances where I feel inclined to do so. I think the troublesome thing is that their experimentation with pitching really worked. I mean, the Clay Holmes signing is a massive success that got kneecapped by an unfortunate line drive injury. I still think the Freddie Peralta trade was a good value for the Mets here, and it's a guy that has said many times that he wants to stay. The bullpen has been great as well in spurts here. It's just this team cannot hit, not even a lick. And I like that you brought up OOTP, because many times when I build a team on a tight budget, I just look for guys that can play their position well, and hopefully the wins find their way. And that's all the Mets preached all offseason long was run prevention. I think the most popular joke on Mets Facebook, and don't spend too much time there, has been, it's run prevention, but they did it for the offense, not the defense.
Hey, you know what? Give it up for Mets Facebook.
Banger. When I read it, I was like, because got me.
I got to be honest. Didn't think Facebook was going to come up on today's show. And I say this as someone Facebook means a lot to me. I mean, that's a social media site that has like given me a lot in life. It is not a place I have ever gone to at any point for any sort of baseball analysis or commentary, but I'm glad that joke, which I somehow haven't heard, has now made its way to this podcast.
That makes me so happy.
But yes, to Mets Facebook's point, 30th in OPS, no matter literally who is playing, I don't care who is not in the lineup. This is also a indictment on the player, like the Beatties and even the young players and Melendez, whatever. I know there's a lot of injuries. Vientos, I get it. But I just, it's so bad. It's so bad. So, you know,
it's 30th are still things, by a are, lot, by the way. I just want to mention 30th by 14 points. Just one for that.
And yeah. And I guess the last thing on the Mets, and then I'll let you pick another team. When you have the offseason this busy, I mean, there's a lot to sort through. Certain moves have gotten a lot more attention than others. But the one that you were posting about last night and the one that I also have been shocked has not gotten more attention is the Nimmo for Semien deal.
Oh, my God.
I did not understand at the time, not that I was like, sign me up for the rest of Brandon Nimmo's contract. But to be like, and it goes back to the run prevention thing, to be like, well, at the very least, 35-year-old Marcus Semien is an elite defensive second baseman. And I was like, okay, even if that's true, but even if that is true, why are we being like, that's the skill that's definitely going to age gracefully and then stay and then be worth the money that he's making? And then every possible fear about how his bat has trended has just been even worse than you could have imagined. And even if you were buying that he could get back to average with this terrific second base defense, which somehow made the deal worth it.
Putting my crash on the screen, crazy.
I'm just like, what are we doing? I mean, let me pull up where he ranks in terms of like OPS plus in the league or WRS plus in the league among qualified hitters, because I imagine it's, you know,
it's got to be bottom 10. I mean, the whole thing that this is, it was such a small market move. And there was rationalization that I did of like, you know, now you're out of those last 2 years of Nimmo with all his neck and foot problems, and you don't have to worry about the 20 million. But like at the same time, man, it's $400 million payroll. It is, that's 5% of what, not even of what you're spending on a year to year basis.
And that has been, this is the last thing I'll say about the Mets, and then I want to hear who else you're disappointed in. It has always been very difficult to assess, like, what are your limits? What are your payroll goals? Where do you draw the line? Is David Stearns trying to save you money and to give you more flexibility? But like, does that matter? Do you care? Are you just worried about the next CBA? That's honestly very possible, but you're still paying all these other guys a ton of money that now you're going to be maybe locked in with this Bichette contract. Like, I don't know, man. That's the part where I can't figure out how they're just making money decisions. And I mean, what it gives you is the ability to have Juan Soto on your team, which you should still be grateful for. You know, whatever happens this year, you're still going to get to wake up whenever next year starts and be like, Juan Soto's in the lineup. Nice. And like, that is not nothing. But you know, there's so much else going wrong that it's just like, oh my God. Okay. Enough Mets. You have a Mets podcast. You go do Mets somewhere else. Jolly, you're back on the clock. Third overall pick, disappointing draft. Go ahead. Who you got?
I mean, this is a stacked class, you know? I mean, there's just
this is why we're doing this. It's like the NBA draft coming up. It's like, oh, all these generational disappointments you could pick from.
I'm torn between three American League teams. I think I know the one I'm picking, but I do think one might be more deserving of the spot than the other. I'm not going with them. I think I'm going to volley them to you because I think you will pick them. I'm going Detroit Tigers at three. I think it's weird because it's a lot of familiar faces, and I liked the roster construction enough with that nagging Guardians bug in the back of my head saying, well, I mean, you know, they're going to be there. But the way that this offense has bottomed out has just been so disheartening to watch. And I was on a pedestal in the offseason saying this has got to be the Bregman team, and it just makes sense. And like pairing him back up with Hinch, all this stuff. Sure, I get it. But for them to not really address the offense at all and kind of just run it back with the pieces that were barely getting them wins down the stretch in crucial playoff games. Like it took Kerry Carpenter hitting a homer off a lefty to get them as far as they did in that postseason run. It's just, I know that pitching was always their identity, but ever since they've abandoned pitch and chaos in favor of a more traditional rotation and bullpen, which I'm not saying is a bad thing, but ever since they lost that sense of identity, they have not been the same team. And obviously the Skubal injury hurts them, and obviously the Carpenter injury hurts them. And Glaber's now in the IO as well. I understand that these things have hurt their season, but any team can really play that card. The fact of the matter is that they just look like a shell of their former selves, and they don't really have the fundamental good baseball things that you can fall back on, which are they don't really play great defense. They don't have this deep, deep bullpen that they've had in prior seasons. Even the guys that they, you know, championed last year, even, you know, Will Vest, who gave up a grand slam to Vaughn Grissom last night. Like, that guy is no longer a guy you can count on. Kenley Jansen at age 38 is closing games for you and potentially giving them away, especially that Baltimore home run with Colton Cowser. It's just, there's so many games that they were on the right side on for a majority of that have gone sideways. And it's just, it's a no good bad season from hell where I don't, again, kind of what I said with the Giants, I don't really see their way out of it because I don't think this is a team that can justify adding, but I don't think it's also an organization that is comfortable trading Tarek Skubal. So it's, what do you do? I think my theme for my picks have been like teams that don't really have answers to their problems as much as some of the other losing teams that are like, well, whatever, let's blow it up.
Sure. Or the teams, again, there are some ones on the board still that are just like, well, just get healthy and see what you got. Or your division sucks and you're probably going to be okay. Like Seattle, I still could take here, but let's move them to the side for now. Everything you said about Detroit is spot on. I think we're going to be talking about them plenty over the next few months because the Skubal stuff's not going to, at some point, if your playoff odds are this low, you are going to maybe have to make a really difficult decision. That is a really terrible way for this to maybe end. especially if he's going to come back from the surgery so fast and just to get traded is absurd. But there's so many things about it. And as people pointed out with the Tigers, like, this is just not a last 2 months thing. This is most of the second half last year. And so that's where you start to wonder, like, okay, how good is this team really?
It's the last month of 2024 where they won every game they could have won. And then the first half of 2025 where they were, you know, the best team in baseball. But everything around that has been bad.
Bad. Real bad. With my second pick, I'm going to take the Boston Red Sox.
Yeah. That's what I was torn between.
Yeah, and I was just in. I was more skeptical on Detroit coming into this year because of how bad it was at the end of last season and because of how little they changed in offense, even factoring in McGonagall. Boston, I was like, look, this has been a stupid way to get to this point, but I actually think their team's pretty good, and I like the pitching that they've assembled, and I thought the Wilson Contreras signing was or a trade was great, and I believed in Roman Anthony, and I know he's been an unfactor because of injuries. So injuries factored into all this, crochet, whatever. But however you get there for a team like this, it's so bad. And then to fire your manager and play just as bad afterwards, the optics are terrible. The vibes around the front office are terrible. It's not Chad Tracy's fault. I was in Boston a couple weeks ago. I'm impressed by Chad Tracy. I could see why people think so highly of him. At the same time, this is kind of similar to San Francisco with way higher expectations because of the offseason that they had and the way that their own team and fans talk about themselves. This is just not a functional group right now. And sure, you could say that the injuries have played a role, but there was a lot of talent on this team, and now they are 22-31. And they're still going to have a chance to scrap out a wild card because the AL is what it is, in the kind of middle bottom half, but they are not giving me a lot of reasons to be excited about them. And the one stat with them that is just staggering, which only really hit me recently, 8-18 at home.
Jeez.
8-18 at home for the Boston Red Sox. I mean, you could, like,
oh my God! I didn't
like.
I didn't,
what are we? Oh we're gonna showing up to historic Fenway Park and just getting our ass whooped? Like, for the fans that are already angry, like, that is just brutal. So, I mean, is that pace gonna hold? Probably not. But that would be like literally their worst. It might be their worst home record in 100 years. So that's the thing that, and maybe that's just a small sample. Whatever it is, it's just one little nugget within this miserable season. That's just like, oh man, to kind of speak to how brutal it's been for the fans, I would say. So
yeah, I was definitely torn between them and the Tigers. I think the reason I went with the Tigers is because they were so stubborn in keeping that offensive core together and not adding to it besides McGonagall, who has been case scenario for them.
For sure.
Red Sox, my rationale was like, okay, you can move Chapman, you can move Sonny Gray. Like, there are pieces you can move to sort of build towards the future. But like, at the same time, I think they're a much more unlikable watch because of the midseason firing of the manager, because of the controversy surrounding Breslow, because it's clear that a lot of these guys in the clubhouse don't get along. Like, you already had unlikable characters on the team that I won't name because I don't want to offend anybody or indict anybody. They, I think, have been a more miserable watch, whereas the Tigers, I think, have been more disappointing. But at the same time, you know, it's just two flavors of bad, man. The home record, I think, is the craziest thing of all, because the old baseball adage is you win at home, you split on the road. The Red Sox are winning on the road. They have a winning record in road games, but they've been so, so bad in what's supposed to be one of the most advantageous places to play as a home team that it's just been an absolutely nightmare season. And I wanted to add this one little tidbit. Chad Tracy has great interim managing in his bones, because Jim Tracy took over for the Rockies in the mid 2000s for Clint Hurdle, took that 09 team to the playoffs with one of the best interim managing records ever. It doesn't appear to be carrying over right here.
Yeah. however, I am gonna, for those of you watching on YouTube, the moment last night where Ranger Suarez challenged a pitch in the fourth inning that was obviously
so
a ball
funny.
And Mickey Gasper is just like, what are we doing, bro? I am going to stand up for the people of Michigan though, because I think the Tigers have absolutely been a miserable watch. The Red Sox, it's been like more dramatic and catastrophic, but all right, let's do one more pick, just rapid fire. Just throw one more disappointment at me before we take a break.
I'll go Kansas City Royals. I'll stay in the Central. The offense has just been absolutely awful. And I mean, we always knew that it was the Bobby Witt Jr. show and then everybody else. And hopefully those guys can contribute, but it's just been so, so bad this year. Their young guys haven't really stepped up and developed in a certain way. I liked the Isaac Collins trade for them. It hasn't really worked out for either side so far because Serpa got injured and they're squandering some really good pitching. Like Michael Wacha is like in the Cy Young race, which is crazy. And they've been losing some of his recent starts. Their bullpen has been so, so bad. They haven't really found any answers there, plus a ton of injuries to guys like Strom and Estevez. So they've been a tough watch. They were definitely a team that I was definitely a little more skeptical on going into the year, specifically because of the offense. And the fact that I think it's just lived up to what I predicted it to be is the disappointing factor for me.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I have nothing really to add there. I'll just take Seattle with my last pick. I think they're still good. I think they're still going to win the division. But when like the thing I've kept repeating recently is this was really the first time that I can remember that the Mariners entered a season with almost more expectations from the outside. Like the national media was like, "Oh, the Mariners are awesome. I mean, this is the team to beat in the American League." And there was a lot of reasons for optimism internally as well. And look at the roster, and they had a, you know, made some really nifty moves in the offseason as well. Brendan Donovan, Rev Snyder felt like a great fit. And that one has been about as basically this year's version of Jock Peterson, honestly. Obviously not the same amount of money, but like Jock Peterson last year went like 0-for-40 or whatever. Rev Snyder,
but in terms of consistency to go into,
and you're like, you know what you're getting. Oh, this guy crushes lefties, of course. Like, he's been terrible. So I still think the Mariners are gonna win the division because I think they have way more talent than the rest of this team, and they still have a lot of good stuff going well. But as far as living up to the preseason expectations and failing so far to take advantage of this division, I mean, there's no other way to say it than disappointing. So I don't think they're doomed, but I also think that they're probably not going to get to the, you know, 91, 92 wins that they were projected to for a lot of the season. Now, they might not need to in this division, but
84 might be all it takes.
Pretty disappointing. Yeah. I think probably more than 84. But right now, on pace, it's like 79 might be all it takes. So we'll see where that ends up. Johnny, thank you so much for being disappointed with me. We're going to take a break. And when we return, a little Abner Uribe chat before a Women's College World Series preview. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we preview the Women's College World Series, there is something that we need to talk about. Jolly, last night I got back from the Cubs-Pirates game, and I opened up Twitter, and I saw a video being shared by literally everybody all at once. And I was like, what is going on here? I know the Brewers won 6-0 over the St. Louis Cardinals, but What am I looking at? Abner Uribe was very excited after striking out Alec Burleson. And even though it was a 6-0 game and the game wasn't over, Abner Uribe decided to make sure that everyone on the St. Louis Cardinals side understood what had just happened. And so he unleashed one of the celebrations of the season, of the year, of the century. And it was very silly. A triple crotch chop that did not make anybody happy other than people who want to get a lot of retweets for sharing a video. Wow. This was something. Now, if you're listening to our podcast, you're like, well, what are you going to scold Abner Uribe? I mean, let's just be upfront about this. This is such a great case of like taking it to the extreme.
Yes.
Of like, I'm not here to defend sportsmanship or care too much about that, but this is so absurd that it's hard for me to be like, hell yeah, I wish every player did that every time.
Yes. And I do think like some people are going to take that angle and like props to them. But like, I think it's naive to pretend that there's not like a line. And I think that line is probably like saying suck it to the opposing dugout like 3 times in a row.
Maybe one crunch drop.
One is, and like to like just anyone, like just kind of forward, you know what I mean?
Right. That's the key. That's the
kind
key.
Of a celebration king of prior years. For There's sure. plenty of clips of him like sure. doing really cool celebrations after strikeouts. So this isn't like abnormal for him. It's not like he had like a vendetta, I think. He said in his postgame that it was Ali Marmol was saying things to the Brewers dugout, which like, that's a heavy accusation. And like, I was actually watching this game because the Cardinals have been must-watch TV. But, you know, watching this unfold live was crazy just because you instantly felt like you were missing pieces of the discourse. And obviously, Pat Murphy, I think, did everything he could, but, you know, kind of had to say like that, we can't condone that. That's not right. If nothing else, it was extremely entertaining. I'll say that.
Yeah. And obviously that's really all we care about here when we make baseball content. So for that, I am thankful. It does seem like he was, it seemed like the Cardinals had pissed him off at some point, whether he, and I'm sure there's probably some validity to what he's accusing them of, and there's probably some misinterpretation or whatever. Whatever the reason was, I'm not surprised that Pat Murphy's like, we ain't doing that. So, I don't know. I don't really know what else to say about this. It's just a very, very, very funny clip at the very least. And because I don't think that this is like harmful, I mean, I guess what's the fear here that little leaguers around Wisconsin are just going to start, you know, triple crotch chopping their opponents when they strike someone out? I guess that's what we're worried.
A PCA situation where, you know, kids are spiking their bat every time they strike out, or people are just going to start cross chopping every time they get a strikeout because they see it on TV.
Right. PCA talking about like, oh no, kids are watching me. I gotta be careful. So, honestly, you know what? If that happens, great, because that means that people know who Abner Uribe is, and Abner Uribe is
household name.
So,
Abner Uribe.
like if this is a way to just raise his profile and for people to be like, oh my god, this guy's nasty. Like,
he's doing it for Instagram followers. How did I not see this? This is genius.
Is he Gen Z? Yeah.
How old is
he? He's Gen Z, right? He's
26. He's my age.
Yeah. Okay. He is very fun to watch, but this is also a great case. It's like, what are they going to fine him? They're not going to suspend. MLB's not is suspending him. So, like, what is Pat Murphy going to do? Not use Abner Uribe? That'd actually be really funny if, like, there's an obvious Abner Uribe situation that comes up in the next week. And Pat Murphy, like, very on purpose, is like, no, you're not coming in the game.
Sorry, he just goes like mop-up duty mode for a week.
Or like they go get him with two outs so he can't celebrate at the end of the inning.
Oh, imagine for the rest of the year. He's a 2/3 of an inning reliever. He has to be
three
perfect.
Three batter minimum, but right.
They
right.
only the bring him at the end of maybe. One inning.
Okay. Oh my God, so funny. Okay, anyway, we obviously needed to talk about that. Yeah. All right, Jolly, our last segment before we say goodbye is an event near and dear to my heart. That is the Women's College World Series, which begins on Thursday in Oklahoma City. And the way we're going to do this, because I know you are not following softball as closely as I am, which is totally fine, but this is it. This is the gem event of the calendar. This is when, you know, the best teams in the country are competing for a national championship. Of course, we have more pro softball leagues, which is really cool. And I hope those grow and get more attention. But really, this is the event where softball shines and deserves your eyeballs. So the way that I want to do this is I'm going to kind of give you the elevator pitch for the eight teams. And then because you don't have as much history with these teams, I want you to decide who you're going to root for. Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong. You don't have any prior affiliation to either Texas Tech, Mississippi State, Tennessee, Texas, Alabama, UCLA, Nebraska, Arkansas. Do you have any prior? You need to state prior affiliations now or prepare to bandwagon. Is that okay?
I am naive when it comes to the Midwest. I will say that.
Great. Okay. Great. Wonderful. So you're in good shape here. Okay. So I'm just going to go in order of the matchups and just kind of take some mental notes and be like, okay, I like that. Okay. I would root for that team. Okay. We begin with Texas Tech and Mississippi State. Texas Tech, a team that is most known now. This is like the modern college athletic story. They've just gone all in on NIL, all in on the transfer portal. Let's just go try and essentially buy a national championship. And that started by getting Nyjeri Kennedy from Stanford for a $1 million NIL deal. She's one of the best pitchers in America, and she is still there. However, adding to the transfer madness, they also have a transfer from UCLA, another one of the best programs in the country, Caitlin Terry. She's the best two-way player, or one of the best two-way players in this field, who is hitting 4.57, and her ERA is lower than Nyjeri Kennedy. So, pretty good situation going on at Texas Tech. And the thing, you know, for their lore-wise, they lost in the championship series last year. Okay? So,
okay.
There's so keep that in mind. Also, their second baseman is the daughter of Jason Williams, like white chocolate NBA Jason Williams.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah, Mia Williams. So keep an eye on her. Okay, so there's Texas Tech. Mississippi State. This is your classic underdog story, okay? This is the team that eliminated Oklahoma, stopping the Sooners from getting back to the College World Series for the first time since 2015. This is the only unseeded team in the tournament. This is their first time in the Women's College World Series. And the coolest thing about them beating Oklahoma is that their head coach, Samantha Ricketts, played at Oklahoma. So she went back. She went in. She said, sorry, I know how to beat you because I played here. I know how this works. So this is the underdog. If you just want to lean in on like, okay, they've never been here, they're trying to shock the world, Mississippi State is your best option. Tennessee, okay? 1.35 team ERA, which is obviously the lowest in Division I, okay? For the whole season, their team ERA is 1.35. And this is how you know their pitching is ridiculous. Carlin Pickens is their ace. Is essentially the hardest thrower we've ever seen in college softball. She's been up to, I think, 79 miles an hour, which from 46 feet is absurd. And there are two pitchers that have a lower ERA than her on their same team. Tennessee has also never won at all, so they're trying to finally win at all. Tennessee will be playing Texas. This one's kind of tough to bandwagon because they won it all last year. They are the defending champs. They are also Texas. And like, if you're not from Texas, are you going to suddenly start rooting for Texas? I don't know. However, they had not won until last season. Their head coach, Mike White, is from New Zealand. So if you have any, like, if you love New Zealand for some reason, get ready to hear Mike White interviewed because it's enjoyable.
Lord of the Rings.
If that's an accent you're a fan of, then check out Mike White. And their best pitcher, Tegan Kavan, is terrific. All right, let's go to the other side of the bracket. Alabama. Roll Tide. Have you ever said Roll Tide in earnest? Is that something you've ever
said? No, never. Never without a hint of sarcasm.
Okay. Well, now's your chance. You can bandwagon the number one overall seed, Alabama Crimson Tide, who have won it before, but not since 2012. And they also just have an amazing pitching staff. Cool thing about their pitching staff is that two of their best pitchers are freshmen. So anytime freshmen show up and are just immediately awesome, in this case, that's Vic Moten and Caitlin Pelosi. That is... We love that. But again, it's Alabama. They've been in the World Series a million times. They've won it before. Like, they're the number one overall seed. So, you know, is that a good bandwagon team? Probably not. They will be, speaking of probably not a good bandwagon team, but it is a fun one, UCLA, 13-time champion. Okay. now they have not won since 2019. Okay. This is very simple what you need to know about UCLA this season. Actually, I'm going to make you guess. They've played 60 games, okay? They have set a record for most home runs in a season, smashing Oklahoma's previous record. How many home runs do you think they have in 60 games? Okay.
Maybe it's an overestimation. Let's say they hit two a game. Let's say they got 120.
They have 200 home runs. They have 200 home runs. They have 200 home runs, John.
That sounds like you made it up.
Okay. No, they have exactly 200 home runs.
That's
which
crazy.
Is like 40 more than the previous record. Their leader, Megan Grant, 40, counts for 40 of those, God. Which is a new single season record. They also, if you like pitching, their ace, Taylor Tinsley. How many innings do you think she's thrown?
I have heard about Taylor Tinsley, but and how many starts?
Oh, how many starts exactly? At least 30 something. The answer is 215 innings. She's thrown 24 complete games, which is more than any pitcher in the field. So
Sandy Alcantara level.
Exactly. She's better than Sandy, but yeah. I see what you're saying. Okay, so that's UCLA, Alabama. I mean, that is a heavyweight first round matchup. It's pretty crazy. Okay, two more teams. Nebraska. Nebraska has, if it's not Nyjah Kennedy, the biggest star in the tournament, Jordy Ball. Now, Jordy Fromm, she's married to a former Nebraska baseball player, Trey Fromm, who got himself ejected from the Super Regional for taunting Oklahoma State, but we'll move past that. Anyway, Jordy Ball is unbelievable. She has a 1,300 OPS and a 1.14 ERA. She's one of the best players we've had in college softball in a long time, and she transferred back to Nebraska. She's from Omaha, transferred back to Nebraska a few years ago from Oklahoma, and is now trying to lead her hometown team to a championship, which they've never won. They have been to the World Series before, back in 2013. Their head coach has been there 34 years, Rhonda Ravel. They have never won at all. So Jordy Ball is trying to bring the Huskers to the top, which is a pretty cool, just like hero story that is like kind of obvious. So I expect her to be one of the biggest stories of the tournament. So Jordy Ball. And then finally, I'll admit, this is the team I'm rooting for. It is Arkansas. And that is because their head coach, Courtney Dyfel, just good vibes. She just seems awesome. And everyone I talk to in the softball world is like, Courtney Dyfel is awesome. And the reason why they're easy to root for is that they are finally in Oklahoma City for the first time. They had made the Super Regional four times in the last like 7 years and just couldn't quite break through. They finally did it this year. They finally got to Oklahoma City for the first time. Their offense is very transfer heavy. Their pitching staff a little bit more homegrown. They have a freshman named Brinley Bain, which is just an awesome softball name, who has a 532 OBP. Love that for her. And yeah, Arkansas is just a good mix of like, I think they have a chance to win, and I love their come up as a program. So there are your options. There are your options, Jolly. Texas Tech, Mississippi State, Tennessee, Texas, Alabama, UCLA, Nebraska, Arkansas. Who's it going to be? And by the way, if you're listening, email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. I want to know who you're rooting for based on my descriptions. But who are you? Who are we rolling with?
Okay. Well, first off, I have some team comps for my baseball listeners who are also learning alongside me. Arkansas gives Milwaukee Brewers. You didn't name any players specifically, but you named a very charismatic head coach. And it feels like everyone's kind of doing their part. Some transfers you mentioned as well. So they're giving Milwaukee Brewers there.
Oh, yeah. Sure, sure.
Let's see what else we have. UCLA is giving Yankees lots of home runs. Home runs is the identity. So I feel like 13-time champion. That feels 27 rings-ish. Tennessee, they're giving me Seattle Mariners a little bit. Low team ERA, pitching wins chips. We all know that. But they've never won at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, this would be their first. They're the Seattle Mariners.
There you go.
So I have some likenesses in mind. Texas Tech giving me Dodgers, buying the chip, you know, all these transfers. You know, lost last year, isn't it? Exactly similar. They're giving Dodgers.
Yeah, sure,
but you know me very well, Jordan. You know me very well. You told me the story of Mississippi State, and I love an underdog, especially an underdog that takes down the top dog along the way.
Yes.
So I have them coming out that side of the bracket just because I want to see that. I love that the head coach played at Oklahoma and then coached her team to beat Oklahoma. I think that is just so cool. Movie script, easy win, charismatic, all that stuff. So I have them on that side of the bracket. And I hope they match up with UCLA because I want them to just keep facing top dogs. I want them to face, you know, a historical winner who's doing a lot of hitting. And I just think that's power versus power. That's a lot of fun. So that's the matchup I hope we get at the end. And I hope Mississippi State takes it all. They're my team now.
Oh, I love that. This is a great picks. Certainly up against it. make it to the championship series, that will be incredible. But Jolly, I don't know if you saw it. They hit 200 home runs in 60 games.
It's pretty good. It's a lot. It's more than I have in my life.
I'm gonna say it. Too many. Too many home runs.
There's a line, and that's too many. What happened to small ball? I bet you they have no sacrifice bunts. They don't play
Do they have any? Yeah, do they have any slap hitters? I don't even know. Okay, we're done. This has been an absolute treat. Jolly Olive, aka Jack, aka Jolly, aka, as I said before, my favorite member of the John Boy Cinematic Universe.
The JCU.
Thank you so much for joining me. Everyone should go support Jolly's work on YouTube, when he's streaming, when he's tweeting through Mets losses. When he's creating content for John Boy, he is one of the best at what he does. And I'm so glad that he took some time out of his Wednesday morning to podcast with me. But yeah, you can follow Jolly, just Jolly Olive. There's only one Jolly Olive. I don't know if there's any impersonators out there.
It's a nice, unique identity.
It's good. It's good.
This was Jolly, a joy, thank you so much for the time. For having me. This was awesome, man. I'm so happy to finally do the show. Now I can put it on my resume.
Good. Jake Mintz, if you're listening, I hope you're not. I hope you're enjoying it a lake. But I hope you enjoyed this if you're listening.
Jake, if you're listening, you're a loser, dude. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Ingrid Rosas for producing as always. We will be back on Friday with Jake Mintz from Italy before some more special guests next week. But until then, goodbye. And watch college softball. See ya.